Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Because it's time. It's time for reparations.
So I'm sick of being a side Indian character.
LGBTIQ rights are black rights.
It's like, it's a form of cultural imperialism.
The only thing I have in common with this character is that she's black. This does not look like me.
I'm Gary Foley.
I'm Francesca Ramsey.
This is Amir Rahman.
And you're listening to The Race Card.
Welcome to The Race Card. I'm your host, Amir Ziyard. And joining me in studio today is Ahmed Yusuf.
Hey!
Now, before we begin, we'd like to do acknowledgement of country. We acknowledge the Kulin people as the owners of the land on which we meet, and we pay respects to their elders, past, present, and future. This land was never ceded, and the processes of colonization, occupation, incarceration, and genocide that began over two centuries ago continue to this day. You're listening to our one-hour show where we chat politics, current affairs, and pop culture with a little bit of a twist. And joining us in studio is Benjamin Law. And today we'll be looking at how Paul Sheehan's infamous article about Louise was able to be published, racism in the fashion industry, and our feature discussion is on English as the language of the World Wide Web.
What's going on, people? This is Akala, and right now you're listening to The Race Card. Big up.
This week we've got Benjamin Law, writer and creator of the new TV show, The Family Law. Hey Ben, thanks for coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pretty big deal for you to come on the show. We had a few really cool guests, and I'm really happy and excited for this interview.
Oh, well, I'm really stoked to be a part of it. I'm familiar with the guests that you've been interviewing, so I'm very, very stoked to be in the mix.
Yeah. So I guess, like, what we've wanted to talk to you about is, like, writing in television, especially in Australia, as a person of colour, a non-white person, is pretty difficult. How do you make your start?
Well, it's interesting. So my background is probably in feature writing and journalism. So back in the day, you know, I think I probably watched like Almost Famous, the movie, and thought I really wanted to be a rock journalist. So I did a lot of street press journalism for a long time, studied creative writing at university. And while I was studying writing, I was also editing the student magazine as well. And I don't know, it's funny, like it never really was at the forefront of my mind that I was a writer who happened to be a person of colour. You know, it wasn't really the stuff I was writing about. When I did become aware of it was when I was asked to write more about myself. And the thing about writing about yourself is you have to write about the people around you, you know, your family, your friends, your partner. And that brought up a lot of issues. And I think it was a really great talking point. You know, the fact that I am Chinese Australian, that perspective comes up in my work just by default. The fact that I am gay comes up in my work by default, as the perspective of being a white straight person comes up in white straight people's writing as well, whether they're aware of it or not.
Let's talk about, like, I guess, trying to navigate all of that, right? Because it's difficult trying to figure out your own identity and how that works with your writing, and also not making that the biggest thing about your writing. I'm not a Chinese writer, I'm just a writer, or I'm not a gay writer, I'm just a writer. Whereas you don't see those kind of connotations with, say, white writers or straight writers and the like.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, I guess, Ahmed, we're talking about being pigeonholed. And to be honest, we don't really have too much control over how we are pigeonholed. And I guess maybe I'm sort of lucky in that I've been pigeonholed in a lot of ways. Some editors see me as that Gen Y writer. Some readers probably see me as that gay writer. Other people probably see me as that gay writer. And to an extent, I'm happy to embrace all those things because they're not wrong. You know, you know what I mean? Like, I am all of those things. But at the same time, whether those things come into play or not really depends about the subject matter I'm writing about. So when I'm writing a column or if I'm writing a memoir, those issues or those facets of who I am tend to come into play. But I think to an extent as well, the reason why I'm attracted even to, you know, the subjects of journalism that I've written about do come from the experience of being a slight outsider. When I grew up in Queensland, it was a very, very monocultural, predominantly white. My family, stood out a lot as well. So you are aware of being different. And maybe there's a part of that experience that means that I'm attracted to other stories of difference, other people's experiences of being different. I tend to like reading stories about people or communities I've not even encountered before.
That's awesome, Ben. I want to know what you're possibly trying to come to terms with through your writing. Like, I mean, other than what I understood was, you know, what it means to be gay or what it means to be a minority group. Like, are there any other things that you're trying to come to terms with?
I'm not sure I'm necessarily trying to come to terms with stuff in my writing. I mean, that almost, you know, a lot of writing can be good therapy for some people, I imagine. But I do know, you know, it's funny, when I was writing The Family Law, which was my first book that came out in 2010, and it's what the TV show is based on.
Yeah.
I wasn't really sure why I was writing it. It's not like I had a mission statement, or it's not like I was trying to work out who I was in my mind, because by that stage, I was in my late 20s. I was pretty sure of who I was. Okay. But I think looking back, I think I was writing a book that I wish I'd read when I was growing up.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Like there weren't many books that I was reading about Chinese Australian people. There weren't many TV shows or movies that I was seeing about Chinese Australian people. In fact, you know, if we even stretch it out further, there weren't many representations of Asian Australian people or non-white Australians, period.
Yeah.
And, you know, I just thought, wow, if a book like that had existed when I was growing up, maybe I would have been a bit more comfortable in my own skin. Yeah. You know, by the time I wrote the book, I think I was pretty comfortable in my own skin.
Right.
But I think maybe it was kind of a letter to myself, like a former version of myself in a way. Yeah. Like, this is the stuff, this is what you are, this is what your family is. One day you'll be able to be okay with it and maybe even laugh, which is, you know, what I've set out to do with the book and the show.
Yeah. And it's funny because many, many people of colour often say, writers often say that I write because I wanted to read something that I could relate to or something that was about me.
Yeah, yeah, totally. Yeah. I think so as well. And I think those things, you know, it's interesting, as this show has come out, most of the response, you know, the response that we anticipated as well has been from a lot of Chinese Australians and, more broadly speaking, Asian Australians saying, oh my God, there's like a family like us on television. We identify with that.
Yeah.
But what's also been really gratifying is hearing people who are not of an Asian background whatsoever saying, wow, that's my family on screen as well. Or, wow, I totally identify with this character and that character, which is, you know, as people of color, what we've been doing our entire lives with a lot of white characters as well. It's like, wow, I really identify with Meryl Streep in that role. You know, it has so little to do with her race or ethnic background. And that's kind of ideally what maybe we want to promote as well, the fact that, you know, I was listening to this podcast with Aziz Ansari the other day, you know, the American comedian, and he was saying, guys, when we watch films, we're identifying with characters who are animated fish or monsters. Like, there's no reason we can't identify with each other.
Absolutely.
Even though those cultural and racial specifics are there to characters, there are some more universal things that I think you can totally explore in stories.
Right. Hi, Ben. It's Amina. So speaking of...
Hey, Mina.
Hey. So speaking of reception and the power of representation in the media, as you mentioned earlier, how does the reception of your work influence or shape your writing process?
Oh, that's a good question. I really want to say no. It doesn't influence it at all, but I totally read reviews and tweets and stuff. So of course, I'm thinking about that sort of stuff. Look, to be honest, it's not so much the reception from audiences that really influences how I write. It's probably more the feedback that I get as we're writing from my editors, if I'm writing a book or if I'm writing a feature article, or from my producers when we're writing the TV show, and my script editors, because these are people I'm working with because I trust them. And so I'm always taking into account their feedback and what they think about that sort of stuff. And when the reviews come out, I mean, after a TV show has been released, you know, The Family Law has played in its entirety on SBS now, and it's been interesting reading some people's feedback, most of which is positive. Other people have provided some criticism. And there have been a few things where I'm like, yeah, maybe that's got a point. But, you know, there are other criticisms as well that you don't necessarily want to take on board or you disagree with. Like, for instance, there have been a few people saying, this show really perpetuates stereotypes. And I have to think to myself, well, what sort of stereotypes? Like, is it a Chinese father working in a Chinese restaurant? Because my dad did that for a living. Does that make him a stereotype? So those sorts of things I challenge and contest. But really, in the end, what we're trying to do is really make a funny, heartbreaking show about a Chinese-Australian family going through a marriage breakup, because that's the funniest thing in the world. And as long as my producers and I and the other writers are on the same page, then I don't really pay too much attention to other people's feedback.
Yeah, and so just speaking on, you know, editors, writers, and producers, do you ever butt heads? And is there anything you wouldn't compromise on?
we always do. No, we don't really. It's funny because season one, we had to... You know, making a TV show is like creating a small little family of our own. You have to have people who trust each other, and you have to laugh at the same things as well. So the writing room was constantly kind of evolving and changing in season one. Now, as we're developing and writing season two, it's very much people that we've had a long history with in maybe in writing season one or in other ways as well. So we've totally got a shorthand in terms of what we find funny. I mean, it's so pathetic, but we were writing a joke for season two the other day, and everyone was like, oh my god, and then this would happen, and then someone else on the table said, and then this will happen, and then Kirsty Fisher, our script editor and our co-writer, said, oh my god, and this is how it finishes, and we just burst out laughing. I mean, there's nothing sadder than people laughing at their own jokes, but we all share the same sense of humor. What can be a problem is sometimes when you get network notes or like, for instance, you know, we're being broadcast by SBS. The parent company of the production company, Matchbox Pictures, is American as well. So they all have notes as well. The only thing that I was really upset about, and this is like a race card exclusive, the only thing that we were upset about was the fact that we wrote this really great joke that needed the audience to see for a brief second, like even half a second, a small patch of period blood, and we couldn't show it. So that's my only thing that I've been upset about. We can't show period blood on television. You can show someone's head getting ripped off, but not period blood.
One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Ben, is that your show isn't like, most notably Tim Watts had a speech in Parliament, which was really interesting. I'll play it in a moment, but he basically said, you know, this is just a show about, you know, people that just happen to be Chinese Australians. It's a mm-hmm. show that any, like you said, anyone could potentially relate to. And I'll just play the clip right now.
Well, I rise today to congratulate SBS on commissioning the recent television series The Family Law, written and developed by Benjamin Law. It's a cracker of a show, a laugh a minute. Though, you'll have to take my word for it, as I fear that the House's standing orders would preclude me from sharing much of the humour in the show in the chamber. I'm not sure that quoting Jenny Law would be considered parliamentary. While we are always pleased to see our broadcasters commissioning Australian content, telling Australian stories, it's especially pleasing that this is a comedy show that looks like modern Australia, because this is a show about an Australian family, but the Laws happen to be a Chinese Australian family. But importantly, the Law's ethnicity is not the point of this show. As Ben Law himself has said, it's no more a show about Chinese Australians than Seinfeld is a show about white people. Like modern Australia, the show's diversity is simply a reality rather than the premise. It's who we are and who we ought to see. We ought to see this reality reflected more on our television screens.
And you know, That point really resonated with me, because a lot of the time we get, like you were talking about before, about stereotypes. A lot of time we get like, and you also reference in that clip we didn't get when I think the Lim family came to Neighbours and they ate a dog. Like really ridiculous racist stereotypes like that. And that was something that you'd always almost see on Australian television. And the family law is a refreshing kind of change. And was that something you were very mindful in the writing process to make sure, you know, like we're just, you know, regular people, just because we're Chinese doesn't mean, well, we're different to the regular Australian, for example.
Yeah, like we were really mindful of it in the writing process, mainly in the way that we knew very early on that we weren't writing a show about race, which I think is a completely legitimate exercise, by the way. Like shows about coming to terms with your place in the world, finding out how you fit in as a migrant family. Those narratives and stories are stories that I'm really drawn to, but it wasn't what we were doing with the family law. At the very heart of it, like I said, it was a comedy about a parent's marriage breakdown and how that affects children, and these characters just happen to be Chinese. But at the same time, we couldn't ignore the fact that this was going to be a show with a 90% Chinese Australian or Asian Australian cast, rather, because we've got Japanese Australian cast in the show as well. And so we were very, very proud of that. We weren't trying to shy away from it. And I think the other thing as well is one of the big things that we've spoken about in the writer's room is, what is the truth of this scene? What is the truth of these characters? Which is funny, you know, you'd expect like comedy writer's rooms to just be jokes non-stop. But a lot of the time we rewrote the drama first. We wrote the heartbreaking pull out your guts sort of scenes, and then we applied the comedy undercut to it later. And I think when you do that, what you end up writing are three-dimensional, complicated characters. And when you write characters like that, you can't possibly get stereotypes. Sure, the Asian dad might run a Chinese restaurant. Sure, the mum might get expressions in English hilariously wrong. But there's so much more to their characters besides that, those facets. And that's how you avoid stereotype.
Exactly, because a lot of time we get those stories, but they're the only stories that have any kind of diversity on Australian television screen. So we get into those, it gets pigeonholed. The only way you can write a story that has a diverse cast is that the person has to be a refugee, they have to have a struggle, some sort of struggle that is race related. Obviously, even your show has elements of race, but they're elements. They're like for example, we spoke on the show before, like race is an issue. But it's kind of like a chapter in a book opposed to being the book.
Yeah, completely, because I think that's probably the lived reality of most Australians. You know, being non-white is one facet of who you are. There are all these other facets as well. Maybe you're studying, maybe you've got complications with your friendships or your partner. All these sorts of things make a whole human being. And similarly with, you know, with anyone, no matter what their cultural background is, I think all of our stories come from so many different parts. And we were very, very clear that these characters would not be emptied of their racial identity. All those cultural specifics, like making congee at the breakfast table, or, watching really bad TV soap operas from Hong Kong, like all that stuff would totally be there, but it would be the texture of these people's lives. It wouldn't be the story of their life.
Yeah, Ben. So I've told Ahmed about a podcast I absolutely love. It's called The Mental Illness Happy Hour. I don't know if you've heard of it.
No, I haven't. Yeah, Tell me more about it.
Yeah,
what is it?
It's run by this American comedian whose name is Paul Gilmartin. He's absolutely hilarious, and his jokes are very like dark, and I absolutely love dark humor. And your mother reminds me of that, of his kind of humor. And so in his podcast, he has this segment called Awfulsome Moments, where basically there's an inappropriate situation, and you basically laugh at that inappropriate situation. So, for example, your coming out story was hilarious. Your mum's response was absolutely hilarious. And for me, that was like an awfulsome moment, if that makes sense.
Yeah, totally.
So just check out that podcast. It's great.
Oh, awesome. And it's great that you bring this new word into my vernacular, because I sort of feel like those are the moments that are most delicious for TV comedy as well. You know, when you really, really cringe, when you're really, really horrified, when you want to laugh and cry at the same time. That's totally the bittersweet stuff we were looking for.
Absolutely, absolutely. So, which brings me to my next question. So you wrote like books before the film. So I want to know what was the difference between like writing for the page and then writing for like film, TV?
Well, yeah, you know, the main difference, writing books is really lonely.
Yeah.
You're writing it by yourself. The only other person who's looking at your work is your editor. And in my case, I'm really, really lucky to have had an amazing editor and publisher, Chris Fike, and you build a really intimate relationship with them. But at the end of the day, it's basically you at your desk going slightly insane and developing weird smells. You know, you could be writing your book in your underwear and no one would know, which is how I predominantly wrote both of my books.
Right.
But with television writing, which was a totally different muscle that I was flexing because my background isn't TV writing. I did study it at university, but hadn't done too much with it. But it is this whole rhythm of lots of discussion. You are at a writer's table, you've got a whiteboard, you're throwing up ideas constantly. And that took me a lot of getting used to, the idea that I had to verbalize a lot and talk to people.
Yeah.
So, but now that we're in season two, I really feel like it's my favorite thing in the world. The writer's room, when you're prepared to do it, is essentially like the best dinner party that you could have. And it's a dinner party where you're coming up with incredible ideas and sharing the most intimate stories of your life. So as much as it's me writing these stories and these plot lines that are inspired by or based on my actual family, a lot of people in the room are talking about their experiences of when their parents split up, or they're talking about their experiences of being a parent, or they're talking about their experiences of being a racial minority. Like there are so many things that everyone in the room brings in, and that gets woven into the story.
Right, right. I was just going to ask, seeing as your show is basically about your family and I write myself, and
you don't only write. He's writing a poetry chapbook right now. He's being very modest.
Anyways,
amazing.
Anyway, so I write, and I like talking about the subject of family. And one of my, I guess, worries for me personally was, is when I do eventually like get work out there, are people going to assume things about family? Are people going to think they know me or know my family and how that works? So was that one of your concerns when you were writing? Or?
Yeah, look, it's funny. I think it might surprise people to hear this, but I am very protective of my family as much as I've exposed them to the world. And the thing is, you know, my worst nightmare is if my family would be upset by anything I've written about them. And over the years, you know, when I was writing columns for Frankie, I'm a columnist for Good Weekend at the moment. If I do write about them, I want to make sure they're okay about it and happy about the way in which I write about them. And for me, I'm usually writing about them with a great deal of affection as well, even if they are shown to be flawed people, which we all are. I want to make sure that we understand why they're acting that way, you know, why my dad or my mum or the characters of my dad and mum on screen behave in that way, because no one's a villain in situations like a marriage breakdown necessarily. And I don't think that was totally the case in my parents' divorce either. So there were some rules, like for instance, if I'm going to make people look like buffoons, I have to make myself look like a bigger buffoon than them, because that's usually the case. And two, people, when they read or see your work, they know when you're being mean. And if you're writing about people in the spirit of meanness, people will pick up on that very quickly as well. So I, you know, when I wrote The Family Law, the book, I printed out the manuscript and I showed them all a draft of what I was writing, because it was very important for me to make sure they were comfortable with it. And luckily for me, as you might know either from reading the book or watching the show, my family's boundaries are pretty loose anyway, especially when it comes, you know, and especially my mother. So I'm pretty lucky that I've got people in my life who let me get away with a lot.
So, you know, we were talking about diverse stories, I guess, when you were talking about being a Chinese-Australian family, talking about, you know, being gay in that context as well, in Australian context. Do you think we're at the cusp of a cultural shift, being more receptive to these stories? So, like, what I usually tell myself is, it's not that the audience is not ready. It's actually pretty overdue. I actually think there is a market. I think there are audiences who do want to see these stories. Is that a sign of a cultural shift, or has it always been there?
I think it's always been there in some ways, just not on television. Like, for instance, there are a lot of, we've got a really great literary culture, to an extent, a really good stage culture as well. Television's really resource intensive, and because we're a smaller country, I think producers and broadcasters are really averse to risk, and to do something different is risky. And so for a long time, Australian TV has been very, very same. Now I think when you've got shows like, whatever you think of them, you know, that Meet the Habibs is a very, very different show to The Family Law. But Meet the Habibs is also now a commercial success. So I imagine some networks would be looking at that thinking, wow, we don't need a predominantly white cast to make a show successful. I hope that people are looking at The Family Law, thinking similar things about our kind of show as well. And I think as time goes on, the more diversity you get of shows, the less these sorts of anxieties about representation will become an issue. Similarly to how, you know, I don't think white people ever watch shows about white people and say, that's such a stereotype of white people. That's because there's such a diversity and such a range and variety of representations of white people that we don't really care about that stuff. That's the point we need to get to in the Australian industry. But I think we're only just at the starting point. What will be great is when Australia recognises that, you know, when it comes to commercial television, and SBS nowadays, to an extent, has a commercial aspect to how it runs its operations. The US is discovering right now that stories and TV shows starring non-white faces actually sell and really do well with a broad audience, not just with an African-American audience or Latino audience, but across the spectrum. I think you're right. Audiences are totally ready for it. I think you're going to find, hopefully soon, that networks and production companies are following suit.
Thanks, Ben. I really appreciate you coming on the show, and I honestly do think we'll be looking back at your show maybe 10 to 15 years down the line and thinking this was the start of something new. Like, we're just hearing about the new kind of Indigenous superhero show. There's Ready for This Indigenous teen show coming out. There are so many other things coming out, and I think you're part of something happening.
Oh, thanks so much, you guys. I mean, to be in the company of shows that you just mentioned, to be even mentioned in it, is pretty awesome. So thanks a lot. And I get the feeling people will say the same thing about the podcast too. Really important conversation to have.
All right, thanks for coming on the show, and really appreciate it, Ben.
Thanks a lot, you guys. Take care.
Tony Abbott was really never a deeply popular figure among the electorate.
Yes. Tony Abbott faced some hostility of his own.
Good morning, sir. How are you? Oh, really?
And really the reason why his prime ministership has crumbled is because he lost the support of the electorate and ultimately the governing Liberal Party.
This is not an easy day for many people in this building. Leadership changes are never easy for our country.
The Prime Minister's not going to lose, he's going to win. The Prime Minister's not going to lose, he's going to win.
My pledge today is to make this change as easy as I can.
Goodbye, Tony. Bye-bye. Goodbye, Tony. Tony, time to go. Goodbye. Roll over. Malcolm's hopping in the bed. Bye-bye, Tony.
Now we're going into the Week That Was segment, where we highlight the most notable or infamous stories from the past week. First up, earlier this week, Sydney Morning Herald columnist Paul Sheehan wrote an article about a woman called Louise, and what was said to be her injustice with law enforcement, the health department, and many a public servant. However, what was stressed in the article was the involvement of Middle Eastern men and more broadly Muslims. Writer and broadcaster Richard Cook wrote an article in The Monthly debunking many of the unchecked source information from Sheehan's. He joins us now. Thank you, Richard, for coming on the show. How was this able to get published with so many holes in the article?
Look, I think that's a really excellent question to ask. And to answer it, we kind of need to go a little bit into Paul Sheehan's history. He's someone who has a track record as a journalist of kind of being a little bit of an intermediary between the mainstream media and what you might call more sort of fringe groups or folklore and rumor, these kinds of areas of public discourse. And that works both ways. So he will take sources from these kind of, you know, blogs and less sort of mainstream media, but he will also glean information in other ways, which then gets fed back into this same sort of world. So over the years, he has made a habit of writing quite inflammatory pieces about race in particular, which sort of exist at this slightly anecdotal level, which makes them very shareable and you know, people feel like he's kind of speaking for them. And he's been doing this for a very long time. And they've been...
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Several occasions where he has tried to get up these kinds of stories before on very flimsy grounds, and other people have kind of stared him down and said, look, you're not doing this, you know, the paper's not going to run this. And what's happened is that he's kind of outlasted all of those people. You know, Fairfax has gotten rid of a lot of very senior staff. So it's really just their kind of one of their star columnists versus people who are much more junior. And in this case, he has successfully kind of rode over the top of them and their misconceptions. Well, they're sort of not their misconceptions, their misgivings about the piece. And he's been successful in doing that. And this is the result.
Because like, there are so many, because I've written your article and I suggest all listeners to check out his article in The Monthly. There are so many holes in kind of like what he was talking about with Louise, with her story, from fringe groups like Reclaim Australia saying they want nothing to do with her, with changing her stories every couple of months and years. And as you said in the article, this was able to be found in a 15-minute Google search, which Sheehan said he apparently had.
Yeah, look, I think that his checking was almost non-existent, really, because once you know this, who this person is, you know, she operates multiple personas on the internet. They are conspicuously, you know, problem. It's very, very difficult to see how you could not do the most minimal amount of due diligence and realize that you had a problem here. And I mean, really, even the story by itself is just so out of the realm of possibility. If you know a little bit about how the police work and you know a little bit about how hospitals work, especially with victims of violence, this would just have to be such an extreme failure of all of those systems. It was very, very unlikely. And, you know, one of the kind of rules of journalism is that when something feels very unlikely, there should be extra checks of it. And it seems like in this case, there were even less checks than usual.
Hi, Amina here. So my question...
Hi, Amina.
Hey. So my question, you know, after this whole debacle is this a case of clickbait? You know, was Paul Sheehan basically trying to capitalize on that currency?
Absolutely. Paul Sheehan is a journalist who has been very careful to build a fan base among right-wing blogs and right-wing forums, especially internationally. So you will see that frequently his work is shared on climate denial forums. Frequently his work is referenced on white nationalist forums, places like Stormfront. And he is aware of that he has this, you know, especially international audience. And so this kind of violence porn, especially with a racial angle, is something that does very well in these in this sort of online environment. So this is feeding to that. And I think this is part of why this has happened as well, because Fairfax know that, you know, he's strong on these metrics. They know that they don't really have columnists who are shared in this way elsewhere, with some exceptions. And so, yeah, I think that the clickability of a story like this is definitely part of the reason why it happened. And, you know, when the story was corrected, I hesitate to say that. It's never really been properly corrected. But at the time that amendment was made, it had been shared 11,000 times. So, you know, that's unusual for a Fairfax story to get that kind of traffic.
You talk about the retraction, right? And in your article, you actually say it's too little too late to apologize now. But even with their retraction, they do very minimal, like they cut out the most obscene bits of the article, but they keep the base of the article there. So, and also if you look at the comment sections, you search in Middle East in the comment section, like if you like search for that, you see so many comments about Middle Eastern people, Muslim people in such a negative light. You put two and two together when you read the article, then you look at the comments of what the original article was about.
That's exactly right. And the original or versions of the original are still being shared elsewhere on the internet. They're still being used as kind of grist for the mill of racists and others. So when you read the amended version, so the two things which have really been removed from the amended version, one of them is any reference to Middle Eastern men, which the paper itself admits were insulting references. And the other is any reference to police and the police actions or alleged police lack of actions. What's so interesting about the story as it stands is that if you take those things away, there is no reason for it to exist. It reads like a very, very odd story now, something which never really would have been reported, at least in this condition. So its whole reason for being was this race angle. That you can see that because when you take away the race angle, there's kind of nothing left.
So we're always talking about Fairfax Media, and one of the cases, I guess, one of the big cases of mistaken identity and inaccuracy in journalism for me was back in 2014 when they mistook the identity of the teen terrorist, you know, the whole saga, where they had mistaken another Afghan-Australian boy, for Noman Haider. And what that did for the mistaken teenager was severe. You know, that boy couldn't even get out of his house. He couldn't attend his own graduation. So those repercussions are real. Those repercussions are harmful. And in that instance of Fairfax Media's, you know, inaccuracy or whatever, you know, that was a personal type of thing. It was a personal repercussion. This one to me strikes more as a communal situation. What do you foresee this? What do you see this as?
Yeah, look, I think it's a combination, and one of the sort of things that this speaks to, I think, is that people talk about lack of diversity in media as being a problem for the people who, you know, it's a community problem, but it's also a big problem for the media itself. I mean, we saw that after the Lynch siege, where you had media scrambling to try and interpret this event. And it was very, very clear that there were no Arabic speakers, for example, who could translate the flag which was being held up during the siege. And I think that, you know, these kinds of mistakes are perpetrated by people trying to report on something that they don't really have any personal experience of to some extent. So that's a factor here as well. But yeah, I mean, these kinds of mistakes, when they affect individuals, when they affect communities, it's just, it's a lottery really, because we're getting mistakes across a whole lot of different areas.
And just talking about the Sydney siege, I remember talking to a friend who, who works at Fairfax, who said that they put together a kind of, showing of different flags and saying, well, this is the Shahada, this is the ISIS flag, and this is this, and kind of like trying to tell reporters, this, don't say this is the ISIS flag, basically. And that was then printed into to Fairfax as a sort of a journalistic piece, when originally it was meant to kind of like to tell young reporters, don't say something that isn't like what is basically a lie, basically. So just to be, yeah, in terms of clarity.
Well, I'm glad that did get printed, but it's sort of strange that you know, people were just flying off the handle, really saying anything they could think of, without having it checked, without having anyone present to check it properly. You know, I think it does speak to this kind of problem with not just personnel being of a particular, you know, nature, but of being from a particular background as well.
Definitely. And we've talked many a time about diversity in media. And Richard, really appreciate your time on the show. And again, everyone who's listening, have a look at Richard's article in the Monthly. It's a really good article. I think it's been shared on Twitter, or retweeted, I should say, over 200 times. So I think that's a fair metric of its success. Thanks again, Richard, for coming on the show.
Pleasure. Thanks very much, guys.
I'm banning all rap this year at the awards. Yeah, don't get me wrong, I love hip-hop, obviously. But tonight, it's all about soul. Yeah, but, okay, hold on a second. I got another call, wait a minute. Oh, Thugger! What's up, Young Thug? No, honestly, man, you are my favorite artist out right now. But I ain't letting anybody in with no Littles and Youngs and their name, yeah. Hang on one second, I'm sorry, y'all. Yes, who is this? Iggy Azalea, yeah, hey. Oh, no, you can come, because what you're doing is definitely not rap. Yeah. Yeah, I got on my overalls. Yeah. In fact, I'm going to send an Uber for you right now. Yeah, come on, be outside.
International supermodel Ajak Deng, who has graced the catwalk for the likes of Calvin Klein, Chloe, Lanvin and Louis Vuitton, has announced her retirement from the modeling industry, citing fakes and lies. And while her Instagram announcement didn't explicitly mention racism, she has talked about her issues with that in the past. So compared to her fair skin cohorts, for instance, she wouldn't get as much bookings. This is obviously in line with a lot of, you know, models or dark skin models, experiences. I think earlier today we were just talking about Grace Jones.
Yeah, Grace Jones. Because like Grace Jones, I feel like was one of, because I don't think she was American. I think she was French, but I'm not completely sure. I just know she wasn't kind of like that American, because a lot of the time we have black models, but they're more often not American or come from English speaking countries. Opposed to someone who, and as well, like, not as dark skinned as Grace Jones was. And she was kind of, I think, like a, we'll say, a trendsetter, someone who kind of laced the carpet, the red carpet or the black carpet for people like Ajak. And like, it's kind of sad that someone like Ajak, who is a dark-skinned model, who represents a difference in terms of the modeling industry, and it makes people, black women, dark-skinned black women, look to her and be like, wow, there is someone I can look to, and especially people in Australia, because she grew up in Australia, I believe, and that's something like I don't think we hear of many, like, specifically black or brown like women who've been raised or brought up in Australia go off and become mainstream models. More often than not, it's the Miranda Kerrs of this world, or the, I don't know, the Kylie Minogue's of this world, or what have you, opposed to someone like Ajak, and to see her queer is just so disheartening. And I think it's just something that we've seen. Like, the other week we were talking about the Brazilian Carnival beauty winner.
The Globaliza.
The Globaliza, and how she was too black to be to stay in her position. And we were talking about, like, a lot of people in Brazil are black. Like, I think 50% of the people in Brazil are black. So that kind of thing is just, it's sad, because this is the people that represent your country, and especially here, like, a lot of, there's a billion and or so people that are black in the world, and that's a huge chunk of audience. And even just by saying that, like, a lot of people who would have looked at Ajak as a, like, a person they could have, you know, they had a, I think, like a sense of rapport with because of who she was. And yeah, and as you said, like, it wasn't explicitly said that she left because of racism, but we all know
it probably was a combination of so many things.
Mm.
And you know what's very interesting with her Instagram announcement? She left, like, a lengthy announcement on Instagram. She mentioned that she was retiring, you know, and she was moving back to Australia.
How old is she?
She's 26. But
wow.
Retiring
at 26.
Yeah, but I think it was more of the, I think it was just the issues that she faced in the industry overseas. But that said, you know, when you talk about the fashion industry in Australia itself is still very white. So, for example, you'll have premier department stores in Australia. I think you already know what we're talking about. They will book people like Miranda Kerr, you know, who also have impressive portfolios, to come all the way from the United States, fly over from LA, come to Melbourne, and do shoots here in Australia. But Ajak Deng, for instance, has not gotten the same kind of treatment. And it's not because she doesn't have a great portfolio. She has, you know, as I previously mentioned, she has graced catwalks and fashion weeks of big, you know, big names. And speaking of which, the way how the industry is so racist, coming back to the whole fashion week saga, I think I was reading a few statistics, and about 80% of fashion week, I don't know whether it's in New York or elsewhere, 80% of them are white.
Wow.
80% are white, okay? Now, that's 20% for everybody else.
Wait, Fashion Week, is Fashion Week, also I'm going to acknowledge that I'm very ignorant about Fashion Week and all the fashion and the whole fashion industry. Is Fashion Week a representation of the entire world?
Okay, so this is where I need to clarify. The statistic that I was reading did not specify.
Oh, but anyway, like, so, would like, the thing is, like, would Fashion Week say, for example, a Fashion Week, would it have, even if it wasn't worldwide, so it's a really bad statistic,
right,
but I'm just curious, like, would it entail people who were, like, all around, like, majority of the world, say, would there be a fashion, would there be people who would be coming from other countries for Fashion Week?
Yes.
Well, let's see. It's a bad statistic. It's an extremely bad statistic. Then
you know what's even worse is if you go to Fashion Week, you know, in India or whatever, you will still see white models there. I mean, you will still see, you know, like, you know, Indian models or whatever. You will always see white models.
Exactly.
You are never short, even when the designer themselves are not white. Their models will most definitely be white, and that's just one of the sad occurrences in the fashion industry.
Put more beautiful people of colour on TV and connect viewers in ways
which transcend race and unite us. That's the real Team Australia.
You know, you look at the American TV, British TV, it, you know, has, you know, it's got shows with different nationalities. And not just putting nationalities just for the point of difference, but creating work that caters for actors of different backgrounds.
In my mind, I see a line. And over that line, I see green fields and lovely flowers and beautiful white women with their arms stretched out to me over that line. But I can't seem to get there no how. I can't seem to get over that line. That was Harriet Tubman in the 1800s. And let me tell you something. The only thing that separates women of color from anyone else is opportunity. You cannot win an Emmy for roles that are simply not there.
Actually, we're going into our feature, but before we do, I'd like to give a little bit of a shout out to one of our loyal listeners who gave us a lovely review on iTunes. And by the way, you can rate and review us on iTunes as well and maybe get read on the podcast. I'm not leveraging people right now, all right? I'm just sharing the love. Sharing the love. Batharan sent us a... I hope I'm saying your name right. If I'm not, you can berate me on social media and swear at me and what have you. That's cool. He left a lovely comment saying, "Love the commentary by the two hosts as well as their guests. They offer incredibly incisive looks into racial politics around the world and take a focus on Australia. They mimic a lot of the thoughts I have as well as opening me up to different perspectives. Keep up the great work." Thank you so much. And also, like, I checked him out, you know. He's got his own YouTube channel. I think it's about, he kind of like looks at like film and cinema made by people of color. I think it's called, I forget the name. I'll put the link out on the post. Actually, I think you can find it right now. I will look for it right now. It is called, it's a really good channel, actually. I was looking at it. They did a feature, I think, Green Stream Hooligans. It's called Filmmakers of Color and Luster. Check it out. It's on YouTube, Filmmakers of Color and Luster. He's got a pretty decent, you know, channel. Check it out. Now we'll be going into our feature. All right. The language of the internet seems to be English. But what does that mean for an internet user base of whom 90% live in non-English-speaking countries, and reportedly 53.7% of the internet is in English. The second highest language is Russian, with 6.3%. The internet has more or less been anglicized in terms of English, but more specifically Americanized in the regards of news and public culture. However, only 13% of the world's web users live in North America, compared to Asia, which is home to a whopping 45% of web users. As well as Europe is home to 23%, South America is home to 10%, Africa home is home to 6%, and the Middle East 3.3%. And China has added more internet users in 3 years than there are people in the US. And there's a growing surge of China, India, Iran, Nigeria, and Russia have had more internet users than anyone in the past 5 years. And Amina, I like to think that there's a change happening that will hopefully mean there is going to be less English on the internet and a more kind of diverse range of languages, because ultimately right now, English being as dominant as it is on the internet could potentially change the way we see the world in the next 50 to 100 years, because it could dramatically deplete languages. It could dramatically deplete writing. It changes everything, doesn't it?
You know, I find it interesting when you say that, because, you know, English as a lingua franca came about through colonial imposition of the English language for communication, right? And so, yeah, it is threatening the extinction of endangered languages, and it has since its imposition, dating prior to the internet. And also it creates less incentive to learn other languages. However, In a study in 1997 by Geoffrey Nunberg and Heinrich Schütze, I'm going to butcher their names because I have, that's just good. Let's butcher their names.
They're just white people names. This is cool. It's cool. Yeah. They wouldn't be able to pronounce your name.
So back in 1997, they had a study estimating that, 80% of the World Wide Web content was in English. And I think later on in 2003, the Online Computer Library Center estimated 72%. The statistics, it's kind of hard to measure this, because I think the World Wide Web is just way too big for you to, quantify and qualify all of that. But basically 70 to 80%, that was according to early research. And so now when you come about the statistic of 53.7%, it's interesting because I actually
you told me you read something else.
And because we do our research.
On the race card, we do independent research.
Exactly. So I came at a figure of about 25%.
Interesting.
So that is a significant shift. That's a paradigmical shift.
Yeah, that's half of what it is. Like that's 53 and 25. That's almost like more than half. Like it's half, exactly almost.
Exactly. And so one of the biggest things that has happened over the past, past decade, is just the shift from just consuming content on the internet to creating content on the internet. And so we see things like Weibo, for example.
Yeah, Weibo. It's like, it's a Chinese Twitter. And like, I remember talking to, I knew a few Chinese journalists who are from the UK, who went to China. They use Weibo, and so many people use Weibo. Sports people in China, even if they're not Chinese, they like Australian footballers that have gone to China, they have humongous Weibo followings. Like this is like a serious kind of it's. I think they're like I've read somewhere there's like 500 million users. Mm-hmm. That's a whole lot of users.
And you know what? I think it's great because there's two things. One is that all of a sudden these Western-centric platforms they have incentive now to actually diversify their language bases.
Yeah,
you know?
They do.
They need to start translating. They need to start having all these options. But on the other hand, it's great that local platforms can arise because English does not cater, Western-centric, let's say, platforms don't cater to them. So I guess it's a two-way kind of thing. But that said, I think we're witnessing a power struggle where the gatekeepers, of linguistic power on the internet are getting scared because Western-centric, people and platforms, they actually don't understand what's being written on the internet anymore.
90% of the people that use the internet don't even come from English-speaking countries.
Exactly.
And like we were just saying, like Asia's 45% of the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And that was done that was a study from 2012. And Africa's 6%, like that shift could be dramatic. And I'm pretty sure it's more than 6% of the internet is made from people that live in Africa. Like dramatic shift, 4 years is a lot of time in terms of developing, development in general. And like every year, like I said earlier, there's an intense shift of people from China, Iran, Nigeria, Russia, who are accessing the internet and are multiplying their user base year on year out. So there is a change happening, and hopefully it's a change that allows for a more democratic sense. Like when I say democracy, I don't mean like a faux freaking democracy that people espouse. But in terms of inequality, in terms of preserving of language, we were talking to Darren a few weeks ago about how he was able to maintain his community maintaining their language, and his younger relatives are using the internet, and they're using that to contact people that are relatives, to contact community, and to preserve language and culture, and that is hopefully what we see more or less on the internet in terms of grassroots people, community groups using the internet as a sense of documenting. And it's very government have no control of the internet and hopefully continue not to have a control on the internet. And it's also free. The internet is free. That's mm-hmm. the thing. That's
the game changer.
That's the game changer, right? Everything is you have to buy for a website, but in terms of the internet itself, it is a free source. Like, you can use Twitter for free. You can use Facebook for free. All these things to actually put out content that isn't like the normal kind of traditional means is free. And as you said, that is the biggest game changer.
And so you were just talking about earlier how non-English speaking communities can document, was it grassroots movements?
Yeah, grassroots community, like community-led movements, yeah.
Right. So that's more like an activist advocacy kind
of. Yeah.
All right. You know, on that note as well, I was thinking more of, you know, linguistic, not just diversity, but continuity. So I know that there is a place in Madagascar which basically used the internet to change over their language from analog to digital. So now we can see how the internet itself is helping document and immortalize languages with few speakers. You know, I mean, if you have a language with 100,000 speakers versus another language with 50 million, the chances, you know, the incentives for international organizations or even Western-centric organizations to come in and find value in actually establishing a website dedicated to that language would be minimal. But as you talk about the democratization of, you know, the internet and language, I think that is one example where, I guess what you could say a minor language, or definitely not a lingua franca, has been able to capitalize on the internet and social media platforms to document their language and to immortalize it on the net.
Definitely, and it's kind of like a way of changing how we see things, right? Changing how we're using the internet, how people are using internet in general, and kind of like giving scope for a more, like you said, democratic use of the internet. And I guess we're about done for this week. Yeah.
We are.
I hope you enjoyed this week's show. We had a jam-packed show for you all. We had Benjamin Law. We had Richard Cook. We had a bit of conversation between us, and we've covered, I think, a lot of things. That's the show for this week. I hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget, you can, if you're listening, wherever you're listening, you can subscribe on iTunes, Acast. You can find us on Mixcloud. You can find us on Podcast Republic app for Android users. That's a really good app if you want to listen. If you're on Android, you could also find us on Facebook, facebook.com/racecardshow. You can find us on Twitter @TheRaceCard. Find us on our website. We have a website now, racecardpodcast.com. See, like a website. We have a website. How amazing.
I know, it's great.
You know, and I hope you like our logo as well. Beautiful logo. Shout out to Bez who designed that logo. Awesome design. And yeah, thank you for listening. And we'll
before we sign off, you mentioned how people can find us. Where can they find you?
Oh, they can find me at AhmedYusuf10, the number 10 on Twitter. Hopefully we can get you on Twitter someday. but until then, keep listening to The Race Card, and we'll be back next week.
Thank you for listening.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Bye.